I tell any secrets of the Mau Mau, this oath will kill me. If I am called in the night and refuse to come, this oath will kill me. If I see anyone steal white man's property, I must help him. I must hide what he gives me and say nothing, or this oath will kill me.
The whole system in this country, the economic system, is such that jobs are scarce. Automation is limiting jobs. It's decreasing jobs. And as automation eliminates the job opportunities, legislation will not create job opportunities. All it will do is bring about friction and hostility between the two races.
You see, there will be no progressive revival if black folks are not deeply involved in it.
I will obey all orders of the Mau Mau, or this oath will kill me.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to This Is Revolution. My name is Jean Bajelon, in for your host, Jason Miles. And he is busy currently traversing the American borders. But tonight, of course, we have a very special show, everybody's favorite highlight of the month, the Mau Mau Hour. And of course, to host the Mau 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 Hour, or lead the discussion in the Mau 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 Hour, we have the one, the only, Pascal Robert. Hello, Pascal.
Hello, Gene. Thank you. Welcome back to the States. I know you've been across the pond, but I'm glad you can make it back over here so that we can host this conversation tonight while Jason is away and on the West Coast doing his thing.
Yeah, well, I'm looking forward to tonight's discussion. I think it'll be a lively and an important one. And just remember, after Pascal has finished his sort of opening statements, we will be looking at questions in the chat. So if you have a question, please remember to just put it in the chat. I'll read it, put it up on the screen. And yeah, let's take it away, Pascal. Do you want to introduce the topic and then, you know, lead that discussion?
Absolutely. Today's topic is going to be a question that's going to be coming up a great deal in the coming political months and maybe even year or two or three, with those who consider our politics to be left of the center liberal faction. And the question that we're going to be talking about today is there a logic to maintaining a popular front strategy with Democrats and liberals for the left in the face of the rise of the reactionary right? So before we actually take questions, I think it will make sense for us to define some terms. When we're talking about the popular front, what were we talking about? Well, the popular front, for those who are not familiar with the history of the concept, is a term that refers back to the time of the old left of the 20s and 30s and 40s during the rise of Nazi Germany, which were the communists and socialists that had been able to become such a force on the American left of the United States that they were forcing the Roosevelt regime to make concessions to them in terms of labor, in terms of working class conditions, that they became such a force that it became realized by those who are in the more liberal flank of the American ruling class that this is a contingency, this was a contingency of politicals that had to be reckoned with. But at the same time, because of the rise of Nazi Germany and because the Hitler posed such a threat to communists and socialists alike, during the period of the Comintern, which was the period of the Communist International, it was decided by those on the left that it was necessary in order to combine and create a united front strategy to combat against the rise of the Nazis, that the left and the radical left should coalesce with the liberals and determine that there should be a way for them to come together with the Democrats and liberals to join forces, which meant that the left did not engage in the rigorous critique and antagonism of the liberals and Democrats that they normally had in order to more effectively fight the fascist threat together. So what the popular front demanded at that time was that the left, which was very strong at that period, surrendered its normal tactics of challenging the Democrats and the liberals for their coalescence with capital, to unite with them under the guise of having to unite to fight the Nazis. And this is something that many people say is required and basically necessary at a period of time where a fascist threat is presenting itself against a society that those who consider themselves on the left are behooving to have to actually coalesce with the centrist or democratic, more liberal faction of the political establishment to combat the rise of those reactionary right pop parties. So the question we're presenting today is that, number one, is it the obligation in the face of the current manifestation of the Democratic Party that we have today for us as progressives or leftists or radicals or militants or however we deem ourselves to form a popular front strategy with the Democratic Party? And one of the first things that I would recognize in terms of looking at this analysis is that how exactly did the Popular Front strategy end up working out for the communists and socialists and the left in the first time around with during the in the World War II period? Well, if we are intellectually honest, we'll realize that once the liberals were more secure in their footing, and after the World War II period, once the Nazis and the fascist threat was removed and taken out, what did the liberals do? They turned their firing squads on the left, and they started with McCarthyism, Cold War rhetoric, and anti-communism and red baiting. And the Red Scare, the second Red Scare that took place in the 30s and 40s, became a normal part of the American life for the left, and it forced the left to go underground. And I would argue that we haven't had a rigorous left since that period of time. Some would argue that even though that happened, it did help the liberals come together and ably defeat the Nazis. But the question becomes, what exactly does it mean for liberals and progressives if the only way that we can come together to join forces with progressives and liberals is to set up a strategy that may end up in the eviscerations in with progressives and the left in the first in the end anyway? Because if we're going to make the argument that the only thing that we can do is coalesce with these Democrats, how do we know that they won't turn their guns against us as they did during the World War II period? That's one of the questions that I always present around when this question is brought about the Popular Front strategy, because it does require us to work with those who normally we have ideological concepts and thoughts that differentiate regarding the strategies in terms of how we orchestrate ourselves in our willingness to fight capitalism and fight imperialism. So what becomes dubious to me is that, particularly in the wake of things like we're seeing now with Roe v. Wade, and we're seeing how the Democratic Party in the contemporary moment has been willing to set aside its willingness to fight on the behalf on the rights of women by supporting candidates that clearly were pro-life, as in Texas, by saying that, you know, abortion was not something that was quote unquote a mainstay of the Democratic Party. If we see over and over again that the contemporary manifestation of the Democratic Party is only interested in lobbying its best efforts to fight against our left and progressive, we saw with the candidacy of Nina Turner recently that there were millions of dollars in centrist funding that were acquired to try to neutralize her capacity to make a run against Chantel Brown again. We see regularly, again and again, how the progressives are being thrown under the bus by centrist candidates. We have this gentleman, Bakari Sellers, who's created a PAC that's tried to neutralize Rashida Tlaib in Michigan, in her district. Over and over again, we've seen consistently how the centrist Democrats have been willing to stick a shiv in the back of progressives. Yet, are we going to say that the only strategy we have to fight the reactionary right, the rise of the Trumpists, is that we are supposed to surrender ourselves to working together with these Democrats in the face of the fact that they have been so willing consistently to throw us under the bus? Are we going to say that this is the only strategy that we have, that our political creativity and political ingenuity is so limited that this is the only way that we can actually find options for us to deal with that? I mean, the question becomes, once again, how willing are these Democrats in the first place to fight the reactionary Trumpists anyway? If they're spending so much of their time and effort coalescing around trying to undermine progressives and undermine progressive candidates as they're doing, when you have, for example, the mayor of New York City, Eric Adams, publicly stating that his bete noir or his enemies are the progressives, the AOC types. What exactly should compel the progressive or left faction of the Democratic Party that has recently risen from the post-Occupy moment to the rise of Bernie Sanders to believe that simply working together with the Democratic Party in this popular front strategy is the most effective way for us to address our problems? I think that this is something that really should cause us to have to consider other options in terms of what exactly we need to do to find a way to really, really address the conundrum that we're finding ourselves in. Because if we are to say that there's no other option but to coalesce around these Democrats, does that mean that we also are saying that all of their attempts to neutralize us have to be completely neglected, and that there's no option for us to actually fight back? What about creating a strategy where we actually go to the working people or the working class or the people, the masses themselves, and develop strategies with working people to challenge the ever-reactionary right-wing posture that's being demonstrated by not only the courts, but the legislative strategy that's being witnessed in the South and the states that are completely controlled by Republicans? Why is it that we always have to go back to this tried and failed strategy of coalescing with the Democrats, assuming that they're in the best capacity to being able to actually combat against the vicissitudes that the reactionary right is going to be putting against us? At the same time, some may argue that there might be a logic to the popular front strategy, in that the Democrats are the ones that are the best resourced. They're the ones that have the best financial capacity. They're the ones who have the best means in terms of being able to find a way to actually fight a more dangerous threat. Some may argue that the electoral mechanisms of electoralism overall don't give us much of an option, because the political apparatus in a two-party nation state like America, where we have two bourgeois parties, does not give us the luxury of going into purity tests when we're dealing with, some would argue, a legitimate, potentially fascist threat from the Republicans, particularly in the face of things like the Roe v. Wade decision that was overturned that we recently saw within the last few days, that demonstrated their willingness to go to almost a kind of white nationalist Christian theocratic state is endless. Does that mean that the ability of us as leftists and progressives to challenge both capitalism and imperialism are going to have to be put to the wayside under the auspices of coalescing with these forces, when we realize that, yes, there is a particular type of nuanced danger to the Trumpist right? Or maybe is there another point? Maybe some of us believe that the actual threat is that the real threat might be the quote-unquote liberals that we might have to be thinking about uniting with in the first place. Is the threat actually the neoliberal centrists, who are the ones who are always willing to coalesce with capital to bring forth austerity, who are the ones whose willingness to surrender to the dictates of the corporate forces are the large reasons why we've been able to have these fascists come to power in the first place, with their perpetual calls for austerity? So I'm not going to act like I have all of the direct answers to the question, but I'm willing to have a conversation to ask, what exactly is going to be the strategy that we need to take to resolve these issues if we think we're going to have a natural, correct way forward, when we are in a situation where we have a relatively new, not very strong left or progressive flank of the left-wing coalition. We haven't, you know, the electoral strategy that was bandied about by many of our comrades who came out of the Democratic Socialist coterie of the Bernie Sanders faction has not really brought forth too many victories. The apparatuses of the Democratic Party are still in the hands of the centrists. The media mechanism is still a fog of this corporate noise that doesn't really have our voices. Yes, we do have a kind of alternative left media with podcasters and so on and so forth and YouTube personalities, but how effective has that been in engaging in the messaging necessary to actually create an alternative voice to what's being normally drummed out in the day-to-day mainstream all the time? I would argue that this situation is going to require us to have a much more creative means to try to come about in terms of challenging what is presented ahead of us. And I'm just not absolutely sure that the liberals and the Democrats are up to the task. And I'm also not absolutely sure that even if we were to decide that we want to make this popular front unite, or this popular front with the liberals or Democrats, that they were willing or able to actually challenge the reactionary right in the first place. How do we know that we're not setting ourselves up to be in a situation where we're going to be working with Democrats or liberals who are more interested in finding points of agreement, particularly on issues of political economy, with the reactionary right than actually sticking and holding with us as leftists uniting with them? How can we be sure that that's not the long-term strategy that they have for the left if we are going to be putting so much energy into surrendering ourselves into working with them? So the larger point I'm trying to convey is that the belief that this is a simple solution, that all hands are on deck, come together, join with the Democrats, and everything will be okay, I think that history has demonstrated that it has not particularly worked in that way in the past. And I think that for those of us who consider ourselves on the left or progressive or left of the actual traditional Democratic center are going to have to be much more creative in finding a way to challenge the particular normative traditional assumption that when a right-wing threat is posed, that we join with the Democrats. And the question just becomes that if we consistently persist in that strategy, when do we do any fighting? Because if we realize that the neoliberals and the centrist Democrats are going to constantly try to lurch to defending corporate capital, and since they're going to become the party of the ruling class, that leaves nothing but the conservatives to become more reactionary over time. If our only response as leftists and progressives is to coalesce with the reactionary right every time coalesce with the liberals and the Democrats every time the right wing encroaches upon us with a new fear or threat, then how exactly do we develop any kind of politics in the long term? Doesn't this mean that everything we're rendering ourselves to means about being afraid of the Republicans? How do you develop a politics that is rooted in anything and outside of fear? So these are things that I think that we need to consider and think about when we're discussing this kind of politics in the long term, because I just don't see what the actual strategy is. Was I saying, well, we don't have time to discuss this now. Let's just protect ourselves because that's what's important. Well, we've been in that space before, and it didn't really end up well for the progressive left at all. Quite frankly, it ended up in our decimation. And what I question, my question is that are we in a position where we can afford to have that happen again to the progressive left this time around? I would like to know if you have any thoughts, if you want to enter into the conversation.
Yeah, I think you're raising some really important points there, because whatever we want to call the strategy, the popular front strategy, entryism, the way that has been conducted obviously has not worked. And there seems to me, and I don't know if you agree with this, there is a kind of contradiction with that strategy. And it seems to be that there's an attempt to push the Democrats to the left through primarying people and having people win primaries and then be elected. Now, number one, that strategy has not worked exceptionally well. The growth of the squad or the progressive wing of the Democratic Party or the Social Democratic wing, if we believe that is a positive thing, has been far too slow. I mean, you know, at this rate, you know, what? How many people are there in the squad? Like 5, 6? You know, how long is it going to be before there's even enough to be any kind of influential base in the Democratic Party caucus? Well, it seems to be very slow progress. Number two, socialists have been exceptionally weak at disciplining those members who have been elected. I think the Jamal Bowman case and DSA is a good example. But also, I think, you know, in general, I don't think many of these squad politicians are particularly responsive necessarily to a group like DSA. DSA are one of a number of inverted commas activist groups that they work with in their coalition. So the kind of socialist sentiment is somewhat diluted. And thirdly, after primaries, there seems to be a general rallying around blue, vote blue no matter who. And although I can understand to a certain degree the impetus behind that in the sense that, you know, electing Republicans leads to, you know, more reactionary judicial appointments, more reactionary people appointed into the administration. So there is a kind of logic to vote blue no matter who, because however bad Democrats are, they might appoint some better people for the long term. If you're going to vote blue no matter who, you have no influence, because you can't, they know, the Democratic Party establishment know that they can rely on your vote, or can rely at least on a large proportion of that socialist block of voters. The only way that you can extract leverage is not simply, you know, not endorsing, but actually openly acting as a spoiler in an election, right?
Right.
You know, DSA doesn't endorse every Democrat, but you'd have to, if you wanted to influence the Democrats, you would have to go further than just not endorsing the Democrat. You would have to actively undermine the attempt of a Democrat to be elected in a mainstream, in a general election. And I don't know if, and that is a politically risky strategy, because what will be the response? The response from the mainstream liberals will be that you're enabling Republicans. And the point is, if you're not willing to sink a Democrat, your ability to influence the Democrat, if that is your sort of objective, is zero, right? You'll just go to them, beg and scrape, turn up to the office, they'll give you platitudes, they'll accept your money and canvassing during election time, and then once they're in office, they will tell you in a very nice way to go fuck yourself. But, you know, you, if this, and there is a logic, by the way, Pascal, and perhaps you can speak to this more, there is a logic on running on a Democratic Party ballot, because access to the ballot is severely restricted in the American system due to this two-party system. So, you know, some people get very emotional about, like, how can you run as a Democrat? I mean, it's just a ballot line. I don't care about it, right? If you were running as a socialist on the Republican ballot line, that would be fine too. But so running as a Democrat, maybe at times voting with the Democrats in the Congress might make sense, right? But if you want to influence the Democratic Party, you have to put the fear of God into them. And even if your objective, and this is what the final thing I'll say is, like, even if our objective is not to shift the Democratic Party to the left, if we have any hope of doing what they, you know, the dirty break strategy, where a whole host of elected Democrats form a new party, you're going to have to get people elected to the Congress. So we have to really think of, how can we get people elected to the Congress if we're playing this electoral strategy? How can we control and discipline them as socialists so that they're the one taking orders from us and not the other way around? And then Are we willing to make the politically risky move of actively sinking Democrats?
Well, I mean, part of the problem I have with this whole strategy is that so much of it is contingent upon electoralism as the only option in terms of how we manifest our politics. I think that part of the problem is that it assumes that the electoral realm is the only way in which politics will be manifested in the way in which the left can become powerful. I think that electoralism is not something that we should ignore, but it's something that's going to have to be done with a contingency on movement politics starting at the grassroots. And the need to have the movement politics starting at the grassroots has not been met by this focus on the squad, electoral, who gets elected, what are the progressives doing in the House? Because no one seems to be interested in getting energy around organizing working class people in their localities around political issues. And it's causing us to come to the point where people are questioning the availability, the viability, and the logic of mass politics, when at the same time, the reactionary right is using those kind of politics to develop a central of focus around their issues and successfully get people to be mobilized to support their ideas and their notions. So what comes to the point is that, okay, we're saying that electoralism doesn't work, but we're not willing to try mobilizing working class people either. So what ends up happening is that we're not really doing anything that is necessary to develop any kind of serious left, except saying, well, the reactionary Trumpers are coming. We have to support the Democrats no matter what. Well, how does that happen if the Democrats are demonstrating regularly over and over again that they're more exigent agenda is to neutralize us or people who speak like us at any given turn instead of actually working to destroy the Republicans?
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. I mean, this Roe v. Wade, and I wrote an article for Sublation Magazine about this, this Roe v. Wade really exposes the contradiction or the disconnect between the rhetoric and the practice of the Democratic Party. Because, of course, on one hand, the Democratic Party is presenting as if, Roe v. Wade and abortion rights are a red line issue for the party or a defining issue for the party. Yet today they continue to support anti-abortion candidates to the Congress, anti-abortion governor in Louisiana. And it's very hard to take that opposition seriously. Not only that, but their incompetence and ineptitude has actively enabled this victory of the Republicans in the court system. You know, whether it's their intention or not, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. But the absolute ineptitude of the Democratic Party, its inability to, play hardball with the right, reactionary right, demonstrates, either it's like a weak, ineffective party, therefore doesn't deserve our support, or B, it's just another right-wing capitalist party that this is just merely a tool which they use to get the rubes out to vote. And obviously I think it's a little bit in between the two extremes. But I think that's the critical point. And I think to your point, what I wrote in my article was that perhaps we need to be looking for strategies, just for example on abortion rights, that bypass the Democratic Party, because the Democratic Party is unable, and B, it's unwilling to take the necessary actions to defend abortion rights. So why even run things through it? Why not do things on a practical level to support abortion funds and mutual aid, and on a political level, fight state by state using ballot initiatives to force the issue to a popular vote and impose abortion rights, not through an undemocratic judicial system like the Democrats want us to do, or do it through procedure, but through a popular mandate. But of course, that's hard work. That's hard work of organizing, and it's hard work of convincing people.
No, absolutely, absolutely. Well, since we're at the half-hour mark and we're halfway through our presentation, if you want to take questions, the question we're asking, I see Shirley came in, she missed the first half, is that we're asking whether or not joining a popular front strategy with the Democratic Party in the light of the way in which that politics has worked for the left in the past is the best way to confront the reactionary right when the Democrats have been demonstrating over and over again that their willingness and primary agenda is to neutralize progressive candidates in politics. So if you have any comments, please make a comment on our page and we will show and we'll post it and we'll read it if we have anyone who wants to share any thought. And Gene, I'm glad you brought up your article because it's a great way to talk about how your article talks about how depending on the Democrats in the wake of the Roe versus Wade debacle has been an absolute catastrophe, because even up until this year they were supporting pro-life candidates. You know, Nancy Pelosi has been making all kinds of statements talking about how, or you know, concentrating on abortion is just too much of a problem for the Democratic Party. The party, I mean, don't forget Hillary Clinton in 2016 ran a pro-life vice presidential candidate, Tim Kaine. So, you know, why are we surprised that the Republicans, are unlike the Democrats, are doing what they actually say they will and actually seeing going following through with their agenda, when like Donald and Democrats are sitting on their hands wondering what are we supposed to do next?
Pascal, it reminds me of something, you know, liberals often say. It's like, oh, well, you leftists, you said there was no difference between Trump and Clinton, between Republicans and Democrats. And all the only response I can think of, Pascal, is like, that's true. There is a difference. And the difference is that the Republicans deliver red meat for their base, and the Democrats do not deliver anything that they promised to do. They deliver a load of bullshit. You remember Obama said he was going to codify Roe v. Wade. Didn't do it. Provide a good healthcare system. Didn't do it. Biden said, well, where's that $15 minimum wage? Where's that infrastructure bill? Nothing gets done. Why? I mean, like, the Democrats are like the mafia in the sense that they're like, if you don't vote for us, we'll let the Republicans break your legs, right? And we have to start looking at the Democratic Party, or at least the establishment of the Democratic Party, not as misguided left-wingers, but as real enemies of working class politics. That the Democratic Party may serve as a better vehicle than the Republican Party for left-wing politics is merely an accident that that party is marketed as the left bank of capital, and many left-wing voters go or identify as Democrats. But we should be under no illusions what the Democratic Party is, how cynical they are in using these kind of issues to guilt people into voting for them because they know the Republicans are so, these days, are so rapacious in their politics.
Well, what do you exactly see as a long-term strategy? How do you see this popular front working out? Joanna says Dems are craving ghouls whose only goal is to maintain their power.
It's not even to maintain power. I mean, like, depends what you mean. They don't even seem to be able to do something that would consolidate their own power. Just look at their opinion polls, Pascal. Like, if this was Iraq, Joe Biden would have forgiven student loans as a bribe to his voters. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. No, absolutely. A lot of people are saying that they thought that the Mau Mau was starting at 8:30. It started at 8 p.m. I don't know if there was an error in terms of what the YouTube was projecting. In terms of but it was at 8 p.m. tonight. It will be showing live on YouTube at 9.
Yeah, at 9 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. So it should be, yeah, I don't know. I just followed what Jason set up.
Yeah, but no, the larger point we're trying to say is that, yeah, what exactly can we assume is going to be the fruit of how this works out with something as crucial as Roe? They're not showing any kind of mechanism to come up with a substantial remedy. All of this talk about, yeah, we're going to legislate a protection for the Supreme for abortion rights. Well, where exactly is the fight of the filibuster that's going to require? I don't see anyone talking about that. It's all smoke and mirrors, that they really constantly are putting through. For example, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, regardless of what you think about, suggested that on federal lands in which we have the capacity, even in red states, we should mandate that it's allowed for abortion procedures to occur, regardless of what you think about that. And what was the reaction by Kamala Harris? She said, we're not prepared to address this yet, and we'll see. When she's supposed to be deemed as the one who's supposed to be taking the position on Roe v. Wade, regardless of what you think of that as a position. Either way, the point I'm trying to convey is that there's no exigency on the part of the Democrats in terms of how to handle these problems at all.
Yeah, exactly. It's all a political maneuvering game. I mean, Pascal, the Democratic, American politics is somewhat clownish in this way. And, you know, we all make fun of the Republicans for thinking that the Democrats are communists, especially people who are socialists or communists who are looking at Democrats and going, it's unbelievable that the Republicans could believe these people are communists, they're right wing. But like the Democrats are constantly warning about the threat of fascism and Trumpism, and they're arguing this is an existential threat to the Republic, and the Republican Party is a dangerous party, perhaps under foreign control. Yet at the same time, they try and bullshit you with the necessity of reaching across the aisle with and compromising. Or they tout bipartisanship as something. If you do, what is it? Is the liberal flank of Capitol fighting fascism, or is it capitulating and enabling fascism by doing bipartisanship? There's no, the story doesn't add up, Pascal. The story doesn't add up.
Joanna has a question. I think the model Kashama Shawan, what is Joanna's question? Kashama Shawan has a model where she's trying to build activists at the same time of concentrating on electoral politics. That's not a bad idea.
I mean, there's a lot to be said for using elected office. I mean, there's 2 points here, right? Using elective office as a vehicle to mobilize people, you know, around an elected official. That was the Bernie Sanders strategy, right? Doug Lane did an interview with Bhaskar Sankara from Jacobin and, you know, asked him point blank. And the answer was basically, well, this whole strategy relied on having Sanders in office as a kind of lightning rod for organizing. But, you know, doing a Hail Mary to get these elected officials to boost organizing seems like maybe a bad strategy, or at least it's putting things in an order that they ought not to be.
Correct. What was his reaction to that?
I can't remember, to be honest. I just remember listening to that and being like, I guess it would have worked if Sanders had been elected president. Then we could have had all this organizing and he could have used the office in that way. That's true. But on the flip side, it could have, because there was no organized base to support Sanders, it could have just been a huge disappointment and demoralization and humiliation for the left. So, you know, like, I don't know. I think you always raise this point, Pascal. Without a stronger organized base rooted in working class and poor people, in the proletariat of the United States who actually have the power to, you know, terrify the ruling class in a way that, you know, soft intellectuals and, podcast hosts and academics do not. Without having a strong base there, our electoral game will be weak. We will have no way to discipline people, you know, like, and increase it. And what will happen is when you do elect socialists or people who lean left like AOC, because there's no countervailing force, Pascal, they end up getting pulled by the gravitational, you know, tug of the establishment Democratic Party into a more and more elite top-down style of politics rather than a mobilization grassroots-led type of politics.
No, absolutely. And the thing is, though, I don't understand why it's so difficult for us to realize that the only option we have to get out of this is to organize on a grassroots level, yet no one seems to be interested in doing the actual infrastructural work to get that done. And all we're doing is constantly talking about, well, why are we getting whipped by these centrist Democrats in the electoral realm? It's because we haven't built the cadre of people who would get confident that all of these candidates are going to be dedicated to any kind of left or progressive initiative in the first place. And I think that regardless of what the electoral realm is, we still have to organize people around the politics where they understand that they need to demand a working class agenda based on what they need to meet their day-to-day existence in a post-COVID reality where we have inflation out of control, we have the economy spiraling towards recession, we're currently in a, you know, posturing towards, we don't even know if we're on the verge of a war with the Ukraine and Russia. All of these political crises are arising. And yet the only people who seem to be able to organize around getting people around their agenda is a reactionary right who doesn't even care about these working class people. It's beyond frustrating, and it makes us wonder, look, I mean, the ineptitude that we leftists and progressives are showing in this moment almost makes you wonder if it's damn near a conspiracy.
Yeah, I totally agree, Pascal. I would add this. Let me just give you an example. I just came back from Britain. In Britain, there's a big railway strike. Right. And the railway strike leader, Mickey Lynch, is going on television and he's absolutely murdering the right wing press. You know, humiliating them. He's humiliating these right wing populist conservative MPs who pose as working class. And the media, Pascal, is even saying, wow, how good is this guy? This guy's going on TV and he's smashing these people in interviews. It's communication secret. And they miss the point is that this guy, Mickey Lynch, going on TV and speaking authentically and kicking the ass out of these people and speaking to working class people in a very effective way so they sympathize with him because he has some fucking special media training, right? He has, speaks like this because he has the confidence of a fucking giant labor union behind him, the railway workers. B, that he has spent his time as a union official talking to working class people day in and day out. He wouldn't be elected a leader of a labor union if he hadn't been talking to working people day and night. And C, he's authentic because he is like someone who comes from the working class. It's not like a transferable skill, right? And this is what we need in the left in America is people and spokesmen who don't speak as individuals who may or may not be charismatic, may not be effective at communicators, but who are able to speak with the weight of working class people behind them, right? You know, people may come and watch This Is Revolution. People maybe they enjoy Jason. Maybe they enjoy Pascal speaking. But at the end of the day, we do not have the weight of a labor union of working people behind us, right? Whereas this effective labor union leader, when he's destroying the media because he's communicating well because he comes out of an organized labor movement that has an organic link to the working class and that can defeat the populist right in a way that academic leftists, even those with good politics, cannot.
Right. And I think that you're coming to a deeper question. And this is a question that often has caused me to really inquire. It is part of the problem is that the class makeup, of the current iteration of the left, is it too faculty lounge? Is it too podcast, downwardly mobile podcaster in terms of the fact that we're not really even connected to a working class? Varn says this all the time, is that maybe part of the problem is that the spokesmen that we have on the left aren't even able to use the language, you know, that is credible with working class people or reach out to them in a way where they can actually be organized. And I think that there may be some truth to that, but still we do have professional organizers or people who are used to organizing working class folk that we have within our actual constellation of leftists who should be able to remedy that. And I'm just frustrated that I just don't see enough effort to dispatch them to address these kind of problems and the conundrum that we're in this kind of political crisis moment that we're seeing.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree, Pascal. I would say the issue is not necessarily that people may or may not be, you know, professional managerial types, educated college degree people, academics and things like that. I think that is a problem in and of itself, in the fact that those people are disconnected from the broader working class in the country, right? But that doesn't have to be the case, right? If you take the old Leninist perspective, you know, Lenin's point was, look, you need a, you know, the working class cannot necessarily develop, revolutionary consciousness itself. That has to be brought in from outside by the revolutionary party. And the cadre of that revolutionary party, whether or not it's the academics, students, all come from the working class, is immaterial. What matters is that they have a strong bond with the working class and that they are trained professionals and do their job bringing socialist consciousness to people, to the working class from the outside. Now, you don't have to, buy the entire Leninist political project to realize that that makes a lot of sense. Like, someone's educational background shouldn't preclude them from becoming an effective organizer. But I think what you're saying is that in this current political moment, the left-wing cadre that exist in America, whether that's in academia or whether that's in the media sphere, is very disconnected from union organizing cadre or regular working class people. When, if we want to have an effective movement, there has to be a lot of more of a closer bond between the progressive and revolutionary wing of the professional class and, you know, poor and working class people.
Well, no, that's definitely part of it. That's definitely without a doubt. I mean, my position is not to say that you can't have people. I mean, listen, I have a law degree. Both of us come from educated backgrounds at the same time, even though we may have proximity to the working class. My position is not to say that you can't have people who come from different classes involved in left politics. But what I'm saying is that when we're not mobilizing the people who are materially are most vested in challenging the system, and we're more interested in the communicative elements, whether it be our shows, our podcasts, our articles, our magazines, or the more intellectual, elements and aspects of left theory and thought, as opposed to this basic grassroots organizing of people in spaces who may not be experts at managing or consuming those products, then I think that we have to start asking, well, what exactly is our agenda? We're not doing this kind of politics to fulfill our own intellectual pet projects. We're doing this because we want to improve the condition of people's lives. We want to change the condition upon which people are living, and we want to be able to help them demand from the state and from capital the things that they need to change their conditions as a society and as people. And I think that what we need to realize is that that's going to take more of us not only simply being dedicated to our intellectual projects, but there's got to be more discussion on how we actually get people to work around organizing people on the fronts to be like, yo, listen, we're at the barricades now.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think, where the need for a party or an organization that can do that, that can warehouse that thing, is most pressing. We do have some organizations in America, DSA, Party for Labor and Socialism, Black Alliance for Peace. But these are relatively minor organizations that do not have necessarily the reach or ability to, discipline people. I mean, the DSA in particular has a kind of problematic aspect to it, in that it's so decentralized it can't operate as a meaningful organization with a clear agenda. And a lot of its leadership is kind of dedicated to basically vote blue no matter who kinds of politics, right?
What do you think is their posture in terms of these kind of questions? Do you think that it's not able to... I find that one of the biggest problems with the DSA for me is frustrating, because I saw it as an organization that has the capacity with a potentiality to be an umbrella organization for a left that could have put pressure on the Democratic Party to create an agenda, because they had this infrastructural mechanisms to reach out to different localities in the country. But it seems like for some reason they never were able to capitalize on the assets that they had as an organization to mobilize anything, but really just like, you know, I ended up kind of stepping over themselves. What do you think went wrong with the DSA in the post-Sanders moment, Gene?
I mean, I don't really know. I would say, though, probably they suffered from the fact that, you know, it's by and large a club, right?
Right.
It's a club. It's a socialism club. And that's a positive thing. But at some point, you need to move beyond club. You need to have a more disciplined kind of party organization where you have some stakes, where you know, it's not just a matter of you pay, you know, a cheap fee or something like that, and then you're a member and you get the magazine, that you pay money regularly, that you are expected to participate, you know, and, you know, have a more disciplined and organized party. But, you know, the DSA's ability to grow was in part because it could be used as a fashion accessory, right? You could pay like a membership, and then you could say, I'm in the DSA, right? But what does that mean functionally, right? Does that mean you're actively participating in the DSA? Does that mean the DSA can call upon you to do something? Does that mean... No, it doesn't mean any of that. When I was more involved in DSA, which I'm like less involved now, you know, the number of the list of people compared to the number of people who turned up to the meetings on a regular basis was like radically different, right? So... You know, what can you expect from an organization like that? An organization where the leadership is almost entirely dedicated to electoral politics. I mean, we can talk about all these other fantastic things, but, you know, that's what the DSA is shooting its energy into. Don't necessarily think that's wrong in certain areas, especially if we're talking about fighting for local politics and at the local level. I think that's more meaningful. I think we should be doing a lot more of that, occupying those spaces on the bottom rungs of society. But, you know, DSA is like completely incoherent, right? Everybody, you know, like, and there's all these different caucuses inside the organization, from race reductionist reparations crew, the ones who canceled Adolf Reed, for example, to, you know, anarchists, to everything, right? How's that going to function as a...
So there's a lack of ideological clarity and a lack of vision.
Isn't this the problem, Pascal? You, on one hand, to grow quickly, you need to be a relatively open organization, right? But in order to be an effective organization, you need to have discipline, and you need to have a stronger ideological line. And that's a lot harder to do when you have to just get people. When, you know, if you want to join a left-wing party, you have to want to place yourself under that kind of political discipline. And I'm not talking about even necessarily like hardcore, you know, labor, hardcore, you know, Leninist discipline, but just any kind of like... discipline, expectation to participate in party meetings, expectation to participate in party work, expectation to abide by the discussion and, you know, and the positions of that the party takes. And there's, you know, there's been all historically there's been problems with this. You know, the problem with the Stalinist model was always that you were expected, for example, to ruthlessly criticize yourself for implementing policy, but never criticize the policy itself once it's been taken, right? Whereas DSA, on the other hand, just has a kind of opposite problem where everybody's just criticizing everything at once, and then you don't actually get anything done. So we need to have an organization where there is discipline, but there's also that doesn't degenerate into a kind of cult or into a dogmatic party in which policy can't be disputed or debated.
Yeah, that becomes a problem, and that becomes even more of a problem when we don't have a clear understanding of how such an organization outreaches to people in the masses in the spaces that they are, and we don't know exactly how to find a balance between electoralism and organization in the first place. So I think I see the frustration, but what's more frustrating to me is that it had the potentiality to be so much more, you know? But you know,
it needed to transform itself from a club into a party, right? And it didn't have to go full. It didn't have to go into a full revolutionary party, but into a kind of more amorphous labor party. But at least one that had expectations of its members, right?
Right.
And it didn't do. It didn't make that transformation, and it kind of just is just floundering around. Still a good place to network and meet people, and meet like-minded socialists. It's a nice place for people. But when I used to go to DSA, one of the biggest problems, Pascal, was that people used it as a therapy session. Like, oh, we live in Springfield and it sucks. And everyone's so right-wing. It's not politics, is it?
No, it's definitely not politics. Shirley's saying, maybe the nation is lost or maybe I'm just too damn depressed about what has been happening. The nation is definitely in a depressing situation and you're not alone there, Shirley. But I don't think we should become to the point where we lose hope. And we can't lose hope in the average American people that we're trying to organize and who to realize what needs to be done. Because the elites will not save anyone. Frankly, a lot of the reason why we're in this situation is because we depended on the elites in the first place. So there's got to be a way for us to reach the common man, to have him get mobilized about a politics that can change this condition for everyone. Because we're not going to do it alone.
That's so true. I mean, we need a popular politics. We need a party. We need a way to develop politics outside electoralism. We need to force concessions, right? And part of the way that you do that is through organizing and through building up, even to a certain extent, building up an alternative social infrastructure. Pascal, you'll know very well. In the Middle East, one of the reasons the Islamists were able to do so well was because they were able to provide social services that the state did not or could not provide.
Correct.
A strong socialist movement could provide assistance in various ways to the citizenry to act like the Black Panthers did, to help serve their communities.
To build community, to build a concept of community. How about using that as a means to build a concept of community out of our socialist politics?
Yeah, one in which you are outside of the state. You know, some hardcore leftists will say, oh, we should never ask the capitalist state for anything. You know, we should always work to overthrow it. Like, no, we can extract things from the capitalist state, no problem. Like, we can get concessions. But we can also, at the same time, try and build our own infrastructure of society, train our own cadre of people who can assist and help people. And we see successful political movements around the world, not just leftists, but, you know, even, you know, if you look at a party like the SPD in Germany before the First World War, it was a huge society wide institution that people played a part with. You look at the labor unions in Britain, the trade unions, they had huge cultural adjuncts to their activity, bands, picnics, holidays, insurance, all these kind of things. Well, we need to be building a movement, you know, that can provide more than just blathering at people.
Absolutely. We building a politics around a movement that's also rooted in community does help us to get a vision in which people are more interested in, invested in something that improves their lives and their condition for a long term and not simply just for a short term. So I can definitely see that one of the advantages of the Islamist movements, for example, the Muslim Brotherhood and the Ikhwan, is that they were like a social services organization. in many ways, in terms of the way they organize themselves. So I can see the advantage of that. But we're actually coming on to an hour now, and we definitely will be coming back to you tomorrow. I think Thursday we're going to have our news roundup on This Is Revolution podcast with myself, Jason. I'm not sure if we'll be who our third person will be.
I think Jason has given us all the day off because he's got Camilo coming.
Oh, that's right. It's going to be Camilo. So we're talking about what's going on in Latin America and Colombia. So I will be on Kyle Kalinske and Crystal Ball tomorrow morning at 11:30. I think it will be taped and will be re-aired. And I'll make sure I'll let you guys know where you can check that out. Hopefully I do well. And Gene, what about you? You got anything coming up?
Nope. I would just ask everybody to go and check out Sublation Magazine, see what's going on over there, and check out and support our articles. Spread the articles on Twitter. We're trying to get the magazine up and running. And we had the event, which I couldn't go to, but apparently it went very well. Pascal, Jason met loads of people. Lots of people were there. Yeah. Was Tucson there? Were you there, Tucson?
Yes, she was.
Oh, you... Has Jason now seen Tucson's face? He knows what she looks like.
There you go.
Wow. That's amazing. There will be recordings of the Sublation event, I believe. So,
all right. So, everyone, on that note, we are out.
If I tell any secrets of the Mau Mau, this oath will kill me. If I am called in the night and refuse to come, this oath will kill me. If I see anyone steal white man's property, I must help him. I must hide what he gives me and say nothing, or this oath will kill me.
The whole system in this country, the economic system, is such that jobs are scarce. Automation is limiting jobs. It's decreasing jobs. And as automation eliminates the job opportunities, legislation will not create job opportunities. All it will do is bring about friction and hostility between the two races.
You see, there will be no progressive revival if black folks are not deeply involved in it.
I will obey all orders of the Mau Mau, or this oath will kill me.